From Maine Public Radio and MainePublic.org, I'm Nora Flaherty with the news on this day in Maine, Thursday, April 18th, 2019.
This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners like you and by Red Zone Wireless, providing a local alternative for broadband throughout Maine. Learn more at redzonewireless.com.
Members of Maine's congressional delegation are responding to the release of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's redacted report. In a statement, Republican U.S. Senator Susan Collins says it is important the American people be able to review as much of the report as possible. She says the Attorney General has provided a straightforward explanation for the basis of the report's redactions and the overall rationale for those decisions. Collins adds that she will not be commenting on the substance of the more than 400-page report until she has carefully reviewed it. First District Democratic House member Shelley Pingree says the full report should be released to Congress without redaction and that Mueller should testify before Congress about his findings. Pingree refers to Attorney General Barr's press conference this morning in advance of the Mueller report release as, quote, an exercise in political spin. Independent Senator Angus King also says he'll withhold judgment until he's able to review the document, but he says the pointed political tone of today's press conference did not match the transparent, objective approach needed to restore the American people's faith in our justice system. He also told NPR's All Things Considered this afternoon that
ultimately, I think the voters in 2020 are going to be the people that decide what was right and wrong in this case.
And finally, 2nd District Democratic Congressman Jared Golden says he is not rushing to judgment on the Mueller report. He says this is a serious matter and that he'll give it the in-depth analysis it deserves. On a roll call vote of 19 to 14 and with no debate, the state Senate has given final approval to a measure changing the Columbus Day holiday to Indigenous Peoples Day. The bill now goes to the governor for her approval. People won't be able to email their testimony to Maine Legislative Joint Standing Committees anymore as of Monday.
We do have a lot of what are called mass emails that we receive as testimony from multiple persons, which are essentially the same message, just repackaged and either copied in and sent from another person.
That's Legislative Council Executive Director Grant Penoyer. He says the current system is very work-intensive and the new app-based system will be considerably more efficient. Testimony will still be included in the public record. In weather tonight, rain and fog with lows in the mid-30s to mid-40s, mountains to the coast. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy with scattered showers and highs in the mid-50s to the low 70s, north to south. Tomorrow night, rain and fog with lows in the low 40s to mid-50s, mountains to the coast. About 200,000 Maine workers who don't currently receive paid sick leave could soon earn paid time off for any reason if a newly amended bill becomes law this year. A legislative committee advanced the legislation this week after Democratic Governor Janet Mills helped rewrite it. Labor advocates are now heralding the amended bill as one of the most progressive leave proposals in the country, while business groups say it's less damaging than the original version or the ballot initiative poised to go to voters next year. Steve Misler has our story.
The plan, sponsored by State Senator Rebecca Millette, a Democrat from South Portland, originally mandated paid sick leave for workers at businesses that employ five or more people and unpaid sick time at places with fewer than five workers. The Maine State Chamber of Commerce, hospitality organizations, and retail groups all warned that the proposal would crush small business owners.
It was seen as overreaching, burdensome, expensive.
Peter Gore with the Maine State Chamber of Commerce says the original measure would have been especially tough on businesses that rely on temporary, part-time, or seasonal workers. But Gore and other business groups also realized that some kind of paid sick leave bill would pass this session because it's a priority for the Democrats who control the legislature. And if it didn't, a progressive activist group would likely send the issue directly to voters in 2020 through Maine's direct initiative process.
Knowing that something was going to pass, knowing that the referendum was hanging over the heads of Maine businesses out there, which would be a very difficult campaign to win, this is as good a proposal as we could expect.
By this proposal, Gore doesn't mean the original one, but the compromise bill that Republicans and Democrats on the Labor Committee advanced on Wednesday. It broadens the number of affected businesses to those with 10 or more employees, a change that would still affect an estimated 85% of Maine businesses, but exempts many smaller employers. The amendment passed by the Labor Committee also effectively changed the bill from a paid sick leave initiative to one that would allow workers to accrue paid time off and use it for other reasons, a change endorsed by business groups for its administrative simplicity and by the bill's sponsor, Senator Rebecca Millette, for its progressivity.
We're leading. We're actually leading on this issue. And I'm really excited about that because I'm not sure employers want to be making the decision as to how their employees use their time off.
Millette says instead of joining the 10 other states with paid sick leave, Maine could soon become one of the first to mandate paid leave for most of its workers. She says many higher wage earners probably already receive some form of paid leave, but this bill, if it becomes law, will provide low-wage workers with a similar benefit. Maine People's Alliance political director Taryn Hallweaver says helping those workers was the primary goal of the original bill, as well as the ballot initiative that her organization has at the ready if the legislature doesn't act. Hallweaver says all workers are confronted with a decision when they get sick, call out and lose pay, or work while sick. And she says it's a false choice.
And the bill that was voted out of the Labor Committee yesterday overwhelmingly agrees. And it even goes a little bit further to say, yes, everyone gets sick, and there are other unexpected things that happen in life, like a boiler might break, or basement floods, or a car breaks down, and people can be put in that same really impossible decision between dealing with what comes up and losing pay.
Still, Hallweaver isn't thrilled that the bill prohibits municipalities from adopting their own leave proposals, as the city of Portland currently is. But she stops short of declaring that her organization has abandoned the possibility of pushing a statewide ballot initiative, a hedge that reflects the bill's still young voyage in the legislative process and the reality that a ballot campaign provided leverage in getting the current proposal this far. That threat, says the Maine State Chamber's Peter Gore, is why he characterizes his group's position as acquiescence, not support.
No one's doing backflips over this, trust me.
Business groups and Republicans like Senator Jeff Timberlake of Turner certainly aren't. Timberlake says the bill is a compromise, a necessary one.
If you ask me today, I still don't like it. You know, I don't think it's good for business for the state of Maine.
The paid leave proposal is among a list of about three dozen bills festooned on Timberlake's office wall under the banner Bad Bills for Maine People. Nevertheless, the initiative could soon become a major legislative victory for Governor Janet Mills, who took a lead role in drafting the changes. Asked during a brief interview to confirm rumors that she drafted the amended bill herself, winnowing its original 15 pages to just three, the former attorney general would only say she was a participant in the process, but she was unequivocal that she will sign it if it reaches her desk. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Steve Missler.
Another bill, which would require employers to provide paid maternity and paternity leave, will get a public hearing tomorrow, alongside House Speaker Sarah Gideon's more comprehensive LD 1410, which would create a family and medical leave benefit program through the Department of Labor. The parental leave bill, LD 1239, is sponsored by Representative Benjamin Collings of Portland. It requires all employers with up to 49 workers to provide 2 weeks paid leave to women who give birth and 1 week for workers whose spouses or domestic partners have given birth. A business of 50 employees would need to provide 4 and 2 weeks, respectively. Curtis Picard is president of the Retail Association of Maine. He says employers are being swamped by proposals of this kind. Even if the parental leave bill doesn't go as far as the family leave bill, he says it too would create more strain for businesses, especially coupled with other factors like a higher minimum wage.
One individual bill might not look that bad, but when you start looking at the collective impact of a lot of these different proposals, it's really going to have a significant impact on doing business here in the state of Maine and really will be a cost driver.
Eliza Townsend of the Maine Women's Lobby says a quarter of American women return to work within 10 days of giving birth due to lost wages. While she supports the idea of paid parental leave, she says the 2 and 4 weeks offered in LD 1239 are not enough.
You know, neither of those is quite enough. The recommended amount of time to stay home and heal after birth is at least 6 to 8 weeks.
Any effort to help working mothers and fathers is a step in the right direction, says Townsend. But she says she's hoping the legislature will adopt the provisions offered in the more comprehensive LD 1410. In many rural towns across Maine, schools are on the front lines of the effort to identify students who are homeless or displaced and help them with basic needs, from clothing and food to health care. As part of our week-long series, Finding a Way, Robbie Feinberg traveled to one York County school district and reports on some of the barriers those students face and what's being done to help them.
Cecilia Siriani's small office at Massabesic High School can sometimes get a bit messy. Piles of clothes and boxes of snacks fill cabinets and shelves. They're for the many students who come in every day.
Yeah, this box is out. You can dig through this one and then we can put it back.
Siriani's official job title for RSU 57 is the Outreach Services Coordinator. And a big part of that job is working with teachers and administrators to connect with students and families across the district who are homeless or displaced and help them meet some basic needs.
These students are also trying to be students. They're trying to be kids and teenagers. So they're dealing with all this adult stuff. Like, again, where's my food? I have to figure out how to get home. I have to figure out I don't have warm clothing. And they're trying to just fit in and be regular kids.
It's a role you don't always see in schools, but local officials say it's essential in this rural district, where poverty, food insecurity, and homelessness are frequent, but often hidden from public view.
And since there isn't shelter, we have a lot of families, I'll use the term inadequately housed, because we are talking about, you know, 10 people living in a two-bedroom home, and that's the best that they can do. Okay, so this is ready to be sent.
On one morning, Siriani sits down with Savannah, a senior at Massabesic High School in Waterboro. She moved to Maine as a young child, and at age 11, with her father in prison, she says she was taken into foster care and separated from her brother because her mother's house was ruled unsafe. Over the past few years, Savannah says she was required to constantly watch other children in her foster home and was treated like an outsider.
Like, at dinner, it'd be them, and then I'd be at the other corner, or I'd make them breakfast, lunch, and dinner. I'd clean up after the kids. I'd give the kids showers. I folded their clothes. I did their laundry.
Savannah says she later discovered that some of her biological family had tried to reach out, but she wasn't told. Over time, she packed her belongings in trash bags and backpacks. One night, she left for good and stayed with a friend.
And I remember, like, I was, like, smiling. It was like the world was lifted off my shoulders because I was unhappy. And I'm a happy person, and I just got sick of being unhappy, and I need to leave.
For now, she's staying with a friend's family. And while she feels better in the new arrangement, she's been forced to navigate a brand new adult world, figuring out healthcare, food, college, and financial aid applications. It's a common story for many students.
So, how did the rest of yesterday go?
Back in Cecilia Siriani's office on another morning, a student has come in who's working to access food benefits. Siriani had helped her submit an application to the state, but she's yet to receive a card. So they call again.
Let's see how that goes. Do you want to put you on speakerphone? Are you okay doing that on speakerphone?
They're put on hold, and after more than half an hour, they decide to hang up and try again that afternoon, as the student has already missed a lot of class time. Siriani says it's frustrating to watch young people try to work their way through a system that can be complicated, even for experienced adults, and one that rarely meshes with the seven-hour school day.
They're coming to school, they're working, they're going to vocational programs, they're living outside the district. Like, how many more obstacles or challenges can we put in front of these kids and hurdles to jump over just to have health benefits and food?
Under the federal McKinney-Vento Homeless Assistance Act, schools are required to transport and educate students, as well as establish a local liaison to work with families, staff, and outside service providers. But Gil Erdheim with the State Department of Education says the job has varied from school to school, and some of those liaisons just didn't have enough time to do the job well in the past.
But I do think that schools are getting better at recognizing that it's not just a role on a piece of paper, it's actually a job that has to get done, and that they're being more serious about making sure that people have the time.
In fact, she says the recent reauthorization of the federal law requires that local liaisons have capacity to do their work, which she says has led districts to begin emphasizing those responsibilities.
So what I'll do is I'll scan this into my computer.
As the end of the school year approaches, senior Savannah has managed to fill out every form and piece of paper to work through complicated financial aid and college applications, made even more complicated by the fact that she's had so much turnover over the past few years. Savannah says it took days of meetings with Sirianni and others to sort through the process.
It was so difficult because honestly, like, let's say Cecilia's position never existed and I really did have to do this on my own. That, I remember doing it on my own and I'm thinking, like, what the heck?
All this stuff is just so overwhelming. Luckily, I think we catch some of those kids and those kids talk to each other. Kids have brought other kids to me, like, and, you know, to guidance. And but there are, I can't imagine the number of students that exist that, again, walk silently, don't know what resources to do, and just feel like they should be able to do this and they can't.
For Savannah, at least, the help has made a difference. She's been accepted to college and hopes to study psychology. She says she wants to improve the system that she had to go through as a child so that other kids might have it a little bit easier. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Robbie Feinberg.
Tomorrow, we'll visit one school that's working with many homeless and displaced students and is seeing some signs of success. Our reporting on issues affecting teenagers and young adults in Maine is made possible with support from the John T. Gorman Foundation. We also today on Maine Calling looked at teen homelessness in Maine. Host Jennifer Rook spoke with three experts on this issue: Chris Bicknell, Executive Director of New Beginnings; Preble Street Senior Director of Teen and Anti-Trafficking Services, Daniela Cameron; and Sean Scoville with Clinical Community Care. Jennifer asked Chris if homelessness is on the rise in Maine.
Part of the challenge is really identifying youth who are homeless and finding where they are, especially in rural communities. Our ability to identify and account for those young people is really challenging because they often don't identify themselves as homeless. They're kind of doubled up with other families or couch surfing around, and so they really don't see themselves as homeless.
They don't use that word.
Exactly.
Daniela, what are some of the reasons for a young person to find themselves homeless, and what are some of the reasons for this surge?
Every young person who walks through our doors has, you know, their own story for what got them there. But we see youth who are coming to us with high rates of trauma, experiencing violence in the home, whether it's physical abuse or sexual abuse, youth who have aged out of foster care and are, you know, don't have the skills and ability to live independently and find themselves homeless as a result, youth who are fleeing conflict in the home. At Preble Street, the majority of the youth we serve, almost over 80%, are 18 to 20. And so it's that transitional age that we primarily see who have unique needs.
Sean, what happens when a young person comes to you who believes they have nowhere to turn?
So when kids first come to us, I think one of the things that we really try to do right out of the gate is listen to them and understand what's been happening. I think our experience has been that a lot of kids that are accessing shelter services have been going through a period of time where they haven't really had a voice or a clear say in what's going to happen next. And so part of that intro for us is talking with them, getting their perspective on it, getting some ideas from them about what's happening, and then reaching out to their family and trying to identify some solutions.
Yeah, what Sean's saying is really important. A lot of young people who come to us, it's been a string of broken relationships and bad engagements with other service providers. So building trust and knowing that you will listen and be there regardless of what they bring to the table is really important.
Yeah. Robbie and I earlier this week had a conversation about a young person who came to the teen center around the age of 15 who had had over 60 foster care placements in her life. And so that kind of disruption in any person's life creates incredible barriers and adds to that trauma that a person, you know, experiences and gets in the way of them being able to live independently and successfully.
That's Daniela Cameron speaking with Maine Calling host Jennifer Rooks. You can find much more on Maine Public series Finding a Way at mainepublic.org, and you can hear the full conversation from today's Maine Calling online or tonight at 7 on Maine Public Radio. And that's today's Maine News. For more stories, visit mainepublic.org and join us tomorrow on Maine Calling at 1 o'clock for a conversation about poetry in Maine. I'm Nora Flaherty.